play to run through the middle of the pitch. Richarlison, Brighton back peddling, and Son is in his kind of area. Johnson!
Hello and welcome to the Late Kickoff Football Podcast. The return of the prodigal son as Spurs get back to late winning ways to lump more ache on De Zerbi. Luton come unstuck against a smug Chris Wilder as they are confused by the amount of possession they're required to have. Newcastle's away form resurgence continues against naughty Nottingham, and Fulham score three in the game that sounds the "it's time for the beach, lads" klaxon. I'm Jamie Guyon, host of the podcast, and joining me as ever is Mike Wood. Mike, how you doing?
Yes. Hello, Jamie. How's yourself?
Yeah, not too bad at all, mate. Not too bad at all. Plenty for us to be talking about. We've got breaking news to bring, which we're going to start with. We'll then carry on with the rest of the Premier League from the weekend. Maybe a little bit touch on Europe as well, given it happened, albeit incredibly unexciting, couple of days in the Champions League. And of course, we'll finish with what could have been a miraculous comeback for Aberdeen at Pittodrie last night. But first of all, to Crystal Palace's stadium, as I continue for the second week in a row to have complete stadium mind blanks.
Selhurst Park.
That's the one. Thank you.
Palmer. Gallagher is on the gallop. Wants to get the back of the D. Conor Gallagher! He's done it again! On the 90th minute mark at Selhurst Park. Lightning strikes twice for the former Eagle at his former home. That is unbelievable.
Conor Gallagher making me look like a right dick for calling him out on Twitter at half-time, popping up with two goals in the second half and the all-important winner. As the commentator was rightly saying there, for the second season in a row, a 90th-minute winner against Crystal Palace. And you know what? One thing I will take my hat off to Conor Gallagher for is he did the non-celebration when he scored the 90th minute winner last season. We've moved on a season and he just celebrated. None of this non-celebration pish a year later, digging Chelsea out of a hole. Probably not really much to be happy about, but ultimately getting 3 points before Enzo went and put a ribbon around it, making it 3-1 in the end. But Mike, we'll start with the evolving news. Late Kickoff Football podcast sources tell us that Roy Hodgson's due for the boot any minute. It could even come while we're live on air, but it's so definitive in this Twitter age that we know it's coming at some point in the next few hours, so we can talk about it as if it's happened. Palace are moving on from 137-year-old Roy Hodgson on his second spell at the club, and it looks like Oliver Glasner of Bundesliga prominence is going to take over from him for the remainder of the season and then onwards to next year. Probably the worst kept secret in Premier League football for the last few months, Mike, is that Hodgson has been teetering to go, perhaps a sign of the respect that Palace have for him and the fact that they're probably unlikely to get relegated, that they've waited their time until they've had somebody lined up. It's been reported that they've been speaking to several possible candidates, but it looks like change is going to come and we might finally see the end of Roy Hodgson in the Premier League.
You presume so. It was a surprise when he came back the last time. He kept Palace up. He did an admirable job, but as you can kind of see, it's coming away at the seams at this moment in time. Now, obviously, that's waylaid by obviously injuries to Elise and Eze, who are vital cogs in that machine to keep them going forward. But yeah, it's a little surprising that I think Palace are at this interesting crossroads in this times. Like, they've been in the Premier League for over a decade now. They always want to try and go and get a bit more innovative. I always struggle with that word. And this is obviously their latest test. They've had De Boer in the past, who was a disaster. They've had Patrick Vieira, who started off well and then kind of evened out. And then obviously Hodgson comes back and to kind of save the day. And Glasner now, he's the next one in the production line of great talents from the Bundesliga. And also, it'll be an interesting one to see how he fits into the Palace team that's, for the most part, it's okay, but what you'd probably say is just lacking real quality outside of the main two players that I aforementioned. The defence looks okay when it's built properly. And I just think they want to try and go a bit forward. They want to try a bit more forward thinking, and they need to move away from the firefighter. I think it's fine for keeping in the division But if you want to push him to the top half, I do think you need somebody that's a bit more tactically astute in the 21st century game.
Yeah, absolutely. With all honesty, a manager that most people won't be hugely familiar with, given that his time has been with probably... Somebody might pick me up on this and I'm about to say something really stupid. I would have thought roughly similar sized-ish clubs in Germany and Austria to Crystal Palace, and so that's why you might not be hugely familiar with them. Frankfurt obviously take a massive following everywhere with them, but I suppose likewise, so to Palace. He did very well with Wolfsburg, got them into Europe. And as you pointed out just before we started recording, Mike, he was the manager that got 20-plus goals a season out of pod favourite Wout Weghorst. So who knows, when Weghorst's loan at Hoffenheim comes to an end at the end of the season, maybe Palace will be going in for the Burnley man and we'll get a third bite at the cherry of big Wout in the Premier League, which certainly wouldn't go amiss. But I think Palace have, to be fair to Palace, as much as I deride them for being largely insignificant and providing very little in terms of entertainment to the league, that is in a broad achievement sense, not in the fact that Eze and Elise are obviously wonderfully exciting players. They have, over the years, tried to get in these sort of project managers with a sort of long-term vision. You mentioned Boer, Vieira got 18 months, and then they seem to bookend it with... Well, generally, they just bookend it with Roy Hodgson. So if this one goes badly, we could see Roy in the box again next Christmas. If he doesn't do something else silly, like take over at Watford again, hopefully they give him a job upstairs so he doesn't have to feel tempted to take over somewhere else. But it will be interesting because we've had plenty of German school managers might come into the league, some with more success than others, but perhaps none... other than Klopp, none with any sort of prolonged success at any clubs. Ralf Hasenhüttl must be the other longest serving, I would have thought, but his time at Southampton started brightly and then sort of became a firefighting job itself for two-plus seasons. So perhaps it was a popular route to go down, but not necessarily a route that has reaped a huge amount of success. Hasten to put a little asterisk to that, that Thomas Tuchel considers himself more of a Pep disciple with a bit of Klopp than he does the kind of classic German disciple. So maybe you could include him in that. But an interesting step for Palace anyway, Mike, and gives us a reason to talk about them for another 4 months.
No, and like Glazner's come from like the Ralf Rangnick kind of school of thinking, in terms of that he was the guy that gave him his opportunity in coaching. He went to Red Bull Salzburg as assistant to Roger Schmidt, who's done pretty well and got moved to Benfica, I believe, in recent times. So like, there's, you can see kind of where the coaching trees come from. And obviously Rangnick was a bit of a disaster at Manchester United, but obviously there's circumstances out with that that made it a bit more of a shambles than it needed to be. And I think the progression through like Reed in Salzburg and LSA and Wolfsburg and Frankfurt, obviously he knocked out Xavi's Barcelona team on the way to winning Europa League, in terms of beating Rangers in the final as well. And I think it's a big coup for a team like Palace to get a guy who's got a European title under his belt, even though it's not the Champions League, of course. And I think the way he's going to perhaps approach the game, it's going to be a bit more forward thinking than Roy as well. So I do think there's positives to this aspect. I do think they potentially become a bit more interesting down the stretch in terms of what you see, what's going to happen with them. But I suppose the proof's going to be in the pudding. It's like, what are they doing in the summer? Who do they sign? And how do they kind of mould this team into one that's very much steady eddies into a team that can maybe push into the top half and compete for minor European spots?
Yeah, especially in circumstances where you suspect they'll lose one, if not both, of Eze and Elise. Both have had serious injury problems this season, which might maybe dampen some of the enthusiasm for them. But Elise in particular seems to be the one that garners the most interest from the big clubs, despite Eze maybe having a little bit longer under his belt performing at that level. But you certainly would have thought that one, if not both, go. And in some ways, maybe for Glazner, one, if not both, going frees up some cash for him to then start to mould that squad under his own ideas as well, because it's very much a Roy Hodgson, Patrick Vieira sort of mishmash. They're not a team that particularly sign a lot of players, and you kind of go through that squad and suspect that any new ambitious manager coming in is perhaps not, I'd say not jumping for joy. It's not a bad squad, but you know, it's not full of your likes of Will Hughes starting and Jordan Ayew and Tyreek Mitchell are probably players that you would have thought that a new manager would want to move on. Even Jefferson Lerma, to an extent, is unlikely to be a guy that you would expect to see in a top-half Premier League team. Odson Edouard was a reasonably big money signing, but another one that hasn't really hit the heights. So maybe frees up a little bit of cash for him to go and do something interesting. But certainly add a dynamic to the middle of the league anyway. Was it when we started this podcast that I said Palace were insignificant and then Vieira made them interesting? I think it was. Sounds about right. And Vieira made them interesting. So maybe they'll do that again. Maybe it'll just be a constant way of making a jibe at me as Crystal Palace, keeping themselves interesting and in the league. On the game itself, Mike, despite picking up the 3 points and despite what looks like on paper a decent victory at 3-1 away to Palace, this was yet another damning indictment on the Poch project and where Chelsea are going at the moment, because they were absolutely appalling for the entire first half and not a huge amount better in the second half either. Got back on level terms quickly through Conor Gallagher, and then you couldn't even say huffed and puffed. They sort of like, I don't know what's slower than huff and puff, like what, like wheezed and whispered from the rest of the second half. But they were, I guess what I'm trying to say is they were toothless and shite.
Yeah, and I think Palace had a lot of shots, but I don't think any of them are of real consequence out with a Lerma goal, which is obviously a low value shot, but it went into the back of the net and they'll count for the same when they're in there. And I think, yeah, it looked invigorated in the second half, and they kind of got away with one at the end of the day. But like, it's really hard to place Chelsea in what they are. Like, they've got good players, so clearly the mix around with the squad. Poch seems to have a rough idea of what he wants his team to be and where he wants it to go. But yeah, it's just befuddling why there just seems to be such a malaise for a team that's richly assembled, that's got quality in it, but up top, you've got Jackson and Madueke and Stirling's off the boil, and none of them look quite like they're going to move up a gear or two. So it's a bit befuddling to what Chelsea are, because they're slowly getting players back from injury, like Chilwell, who comes into the defence, is much better left back than the likes of Cucurella. Of course, still missing Reece James, but that's been an ongoing problem for years in terms of his patchy injury record. So it's just confusing where Chelsea are, because they could be taking advantage of a few teams kind of underperforming this season, but it hasn't come together and united well together.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you look at the league, and granted they play Man City, but theoretically they could finish this weekend in seventh place, which would be absolutely bonkers, given that there's quite a clear top six, or on paper over the last decade, a clear top six, and then Villa are overperforming. It would almost put them exactly where they would hope to be, which, given how dreadful the season's been, is quite bizarre. Taking advantage of sort of Brighton, West Ham's poorer form, of Newcastle are kind of bouncing back now, so it might be a bit trickier. But yeah, if they were to find themselves suddenly seventh with a possibility of getting a place in Europe, given that the Premier League might get 5 Champions League spots, then you've got the Europa and the Europa Conference. They're in a cup final, which is next weekend, and, you know, every chance as much as anybody else does in the FA Cup as well. Like, what has been an absolutely dreadful season could end up finishing with 2 trophies in European football, which would be bonkers. You're absolutely right. They are difficult to assess. And I was very surprised that they didn't go for a striker in January. Hopefully that means that they're kind of taking their time and something big will come in the summer. But I think ever since Thomas Tuchel took over from Frank Lampard, which was what, January, February 21?
Yeah,
I think since Tuchel took over from Lampard, what we've seen is a richly assembled squad that could be a lot better if it just had somebody to put the ball in the back of the net. And I think that's obviously been a problem now for sort of 2.5-3 seasons. And again, in this game, there was just no focal point. You know, Cole Palmer was completely lost, sort of playing in that strange false nine-ish kind of position that he was in. And that was notwithstanding the fact that Nicholas Jackson was on the pitch, but he seemed to be playing on the left. And then Conor Gallagher was just being his usual busybody, and Madueke was incredibly poor, but it just seemed like nobody had anything to work around. It kind of seemed to get the worst out of everybody. So it sounds like a simple solution, and I'm sure every team wants a striker to put the ball in the net, but we've seen how much of a difference it can make at other clubs, and you think perhaps it is as simple as that for Chelsea, that might start pushing them in the right direction. But at the moment, I suspect that there's no corners have been turned, and they'll get absolutely thumped by Man City at the weekend, as they did Liverpool, and then they'll go to the cup final, and you know, it's a coin toss in a cup final, really, and we'll see what happens. But the main talking point from that, obviously, being Roy Hodgson. Any more, Mike?
No, I don't believe so.
Perfect. What we'll do now is we'll move on to the title protagonists, where we'll focus our attention, but touching on their opponents, of course, as we go, and the stories that they allude to throughout the rest of the league, starting at the Etihad.
Alvarez, headed down by Diaz. Ake couldn't get it. Haaland! It took till the 71st minute, but at last, the Blues have found a way. Haaland's first goal since November. And the big man is back in the goals.
I think we need to start with the celebration. I have never seen a celebration like that in my entire life. It's absolutely fucking mental. How has he not injured himself? I've genuinely never seen it. And if you don't, like, anybody that doesn't know what I'm talking about, go and double check this goal. But he scores what is a good goal. And then he doesn't do a knee slide. He does an arse slide. But he does an arse slide by like jumping from 5 feet in the air and just landing on his arse and somehow sliding with his legs abreast. Like, it's absolutely mental. That's the strangest celebration I've ever seen. I don't understand how it's physically possible for him to jump that high, land that hard, and continue to slide. And also without like toppling over or pulling a hamstring or pulling a groin or something. Fucking mad when he did it. I was like, what the fuck is that? But yeah, celebration police aside, Mike, Haaland getting back on the score sheet, first time since November, would have you think that he was in some kind of drought as they finally overcame an Everton side that do seem to be able to consistently make City struggle. But I think it's maybe a sign of post-Christmas City, which the interviewer said on Match of the Day as well. He said, you know, this is Man City after Christmas, so that means you just find a way of getting it done. But there's a lot of truth in that, isn't there?
Well, they won at the week, the one midweek against Copenhagen as well. Scott McInnes, Copenhagen, of course. That's 11 wins in a row from now. So yeah, they're motoring on very nicely. And while they kind of struggled against Evans, kind of low block, and the way Sean Dyche sets up his team's defensively minded, listen, he's done tremendously well in doing that so far this season. But when you've got somebody like Haaland, he only needs the one chance, and he's proven that here again as well. Like, it's not an easy, his first goal was not an easy opportunity to take, and he's patched through a plum. And the second was just, I don't know about you, but it's just like, the way he moves and the way he strikes the ball, it just seems inevitable the way he's going to score. Like, you can see what he's going to do and exactly the way he's going to do it, but goalkeeper's just another chance because he finishes it that expertly. And like, you have that confidence when he gets into the box and he gets a stride upon him that he's going to put in the back of the net, whereas you don't see that with many strikers, or don't feel very confident with many strikers, like your Nick Jacksons, Darwin Nunez's, even Gabriel Jesus, he's like, you feel like they need three or four of those kind of chances to put one away, whereas Haaland, it's just so pitch perfect that he knows exactly what he's doing in that position. And yeah, when you've got Haaland on the pitch, it's making things much easier for Manchester City, and that goes without saying. But obviously, when you've got De Bruyne, perhaps the best playmaker that the division's ever seen in tow as well, then yeah, the job just gets so much more simpler for Pep in terms of what he needs the players to do and execute the game plan perfectly. And like, it took him a while I think it was only a couple of games in Pep's history in the Premier League where it took them longer to get a shot on target, but once they went in, then they went on to be comfortable winners and keep a clean sheet, which hasn't been the case for City for a while now as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And on Haaland, it's almost like Henry-esque, isn't it? Henry's like the way that he shapes himself and that you're comfortable. He actually had a very similar chance against Brentford and he tried a very similar finish and Flecken saved it. And it was almost like that was him just getting his eye back in after this long injury. Because when he, like you say, when he ran through for this one, there was absolutely no doubt that however he wanted to finish it, he was, whether he slotted it home, whether he went round the keeper, the way that he leaves Braithwaite in his wake as well. It was like an NFL stiff arm, the way he just like almost throws him down to the floor, Derek Henry-esque in that sort of famous clip. I thought Martin Keown's analysis, I know Martin Keown's a Premier League winning centre-half, right? But I was listening to it thinking, what a load of shite. What an absolute load of shite, Keown. That he doesn't turn, the reason that he doesn't stop that goal is that he doesn't turn his head like an owl ever so slightly quicker and somehow shift his entire hips and body weight around to run in a completely different direction because of Haaland. I can't help think that he's just tried to sound clever for the sake of sounding clever. Like, Braithwaite's running. He can see the ball. He knows where Haaland is. And he's literally right next to Haaland. Like, the reason that he doesn't get the ball is not because he did anything wrong. It's because Haaland's absolutely perfect in that situation. And without, what's he meant to do? Without fouling him, I don't really see what the difference is. It's that, was it a basketball coach? I can't remember who. I think it was a basketball coach that said, like, a perfect attack will always beat a perfect defence. It's like a quote along those lines. Like, have the best defence in the world, but the best attack should always beat it. And that's all that was. It was just, you know, Braithwaite could have done whatever he wanted, but Haaland, when he gets running like that with his pace and power, was always gonna get through. And it is a sublimely calm finish and a saviour for my draft fantasy Premier League season as well, as I've spent 8 weeks for Haaland on the bench praying that he got fit again and thrusting me to victory this weekend fantastically. Not much to say on Everton really in this game, Mike. They did what they could. It's one of them where we see if you dig in like this and don't get the win, you don't really deserve any credit. And I don't think Everton do particularly deserve any credit. But equally, I think you can sympathise with the fact that the way they approached the game was probably going to be the only way that they would have managed to have got anything out of it and nearly did in a sense that they took it to the last 20 minutes, but also nearly didn't in any way because they themselves didn't particularly have any shots in anger.
No, and it doesn't really help when you're the most underperforming team in terms of goals as well, to only generate 0.2 XG. Like Cavallone's not that kind of finisher. Beto's certainly not that type of finisher either. I think we could take a lot of solace, obviously, in the first half of how things did. But yeah, you need to kind of build upon that, and it's nigh on impossible, especially say at home as well, that you're going to potentially kind of trouble them. Obviously, Palace is under Hodgson, has managed to do so for a number of seasons now, but Pep always seems to have those kind of weird results, like the Wolves manager, Nuno, when Nuno was managing them, he always seemed to get a result against Manchester City. So they're like, there's ways of being defensively stout and solid and managing to hit them on the counter attack and do it once. But I don't think there's a consistent way of doing it that you can trouble City for an entire season doing those kind of same things over and over again. I don't think it works. And I think Everton are just really struggling.
Exercising a proper quit after score. 3 days.
Sorry.
That's something that I was finishing my point on, just like Everton. Everyone's struggling to find a consistent goal scorer. One, if they can stay fit, if it's Calvert-Lewin, and two, the backup in Bells. I don't think he's just simply not good enough.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Bettles turned out to be a bit of a strange signing. It's easy for me to say in hindsight, isn't it? But it's not been one that's worked more to the point. Any more on Manchester City's impending league victory and dominance, Mike? If not, we can move on.
No, I just think they are there or thereabouts now in terms of progressing forward, in terms of really challenging for the league title now, and they've got the stride back. They're 2 points off the top from Liverpool. I do think they're definitely going to be there or thereabouts. I think whatever kind of issue, problem they had kind of mid-season there, has been rectified, and yeah, now it's definitely a three-way race for the title.
Perhaps worth just noting slightly as well is obviously the return of John Stones is massive. I think it's one of those things that gets said a lot and maybe doesn't get taken seriously a lot, but they're a totally different team with him, their ability to play out from the back and then and spring attacks from further back, much like Liverpool have copied with Trent, makes a massive difference. It was interesting to see him playing from fullback in this game rather than from centre-back. Previously, he's played at centre-back and stepped up through the middle, which then engages the press from the other team. But here he was doing more of a sort of inverted fullback role, like Trent does for Liverpool and like we've seen Arteta try for Arsenal as well. And it took City a long time to break them down, it did give them like complete and utter control for that entire game. I think he's absolutely massive to the way they want to play. And it'll be interesting to see, last season he sort of avoided Pep Roulette once he came into this ball-playing role. And it'll be interesting to see if he continues to avoid Pep Roulette while they remain sort of in a title race. Perhaps if they were to shrug off the challengers, focuses would change. But I suspect he could be in the sort of Kevin De Bruyne, Erling Haaland camp of 90 minutes twice a week now until the summer, if he can stay injury free. One of those title contenders finished the weekend off emphatically at the London Stadium.
Ben White. Oh, Odegaard and Trossard left it for each other. Oh, what a finish from Declan Rice! 6-0 to Arsenal. A superb strike from Declan Rice.
I think that goal perfectly sums up West Ham's day, where there's a cutback, two players get in each other's way, and so Declan Rice steps up from 25 yards and just whips it into the far corner, then cracking out his best non-celebration. It was a weekend of whether to not celebrate or celebrate. Because we didn't mention it, given that it was in the opening clip, sorry to jump about a bit, but Brennan Johnson had a fucking bizarre celebration for his winner against Brighton as well. Like, I think it was on The Guardian, one of their contributors said, I had to double check that he hadn't played for Brighton because it was such a non-celebration for a 90th minute winner. But he like sticks it away and just walks off. It was almost like Cantona-esque. And yeah, I'm Brennan Johnson. That's what I do. I scored 90th minute winners. Even though he's not Cantona, he's Brennan Johnson. It was so, so peculiar. And then obviously, yeah, as we've spoken about Gallagher and Haaland. So yeah, it was funny to see Rice went classic as well. He went full like two arms, like a bird trying to take off. Like, no, everybody calm down. They calm down. I've only humiliated my former team by putting a sixth goal past them. That's plenty. But yeah, Mike, quite a bonkers result in the end, this one for Arsenal against a West Ham team that now haven't won in their last five Premier League games. But it was just that crazy period, sort of 13 minutes before half time, and Arsenal going 4-0 up, game's over. And yeah, West Ham. Well, I guess we should start with Arsenal, shouldn't we? Because it's the positive. It's easy to go with the negative. And being an Arsenal fan, you must be delighted with that result, because perhaps it was a team that if both were in form, you would have thought could have been a sticky wicket for Arsenal.
Well, I mean, it has obviously during the festive period, the West Ham had a game plan, executed to perfection, and got out of the Emirates with all 3 points. And you transpose it to this game, they just fell apart at the seams. It looked so disjointed in terms of their organisation from set plays. Now Arsenal will disrupt you, and they're one of the better teams from set plays. So, of course, that comes with that caveat. But for a David Moyes team to be so out of kilter, you kind of wonder, like, then what's the point of a David Moyes team if they can't defend well? And I can understand his kind of... I think he was quite measured in his post-match comments, to be fair to him, in terms of the way he kind of said, I take the share of my responsibility. But he's absolutely right that the players had to take their share of responsibility, because you had Ben Johnson looking the wrong way at one of the corners, and it's like that's simply not good enough. It's like you're a defender by trade. You've been there to double up on Saka on that side of the wing, and now you're not even looking at the right way for around the corner, and the free kick's going to come in. So Arsenal took advantage of a team who just had a very, very poor day. Miller tactics were spot on. I don't think it was not necessarily much of a tactical battle in terms of Arsenal needed to be at the races. They just had a mad 15 minutes where they scored four goals, job done, and obviously pitched up two later on at the end. And I think that's just the way things have gone about for Arsenal. Like, they've kind of proven that you don't need the guy that's going to stick the ball in the back of the net on a consistent basis. While it'd be nice, they're sharing their goals around with the team in the set place. Gabriel, of course, getting another one. Saliba again, his second of the season. I think Arsenal are very, very good. And if it wasn't for Man City, they'd kind of run away with the title in the end. But there's a lot to be kind of joyful when you're watching Arsenal these days, because it just seems to all work. And while even boys like Havertz aren't having the best of times, they still provide a function to this team in the way that they operate. And I think that's still important. And when you've got boys that can fill in like Trossard as well, it's a nicely set up and balanced team. Well, it needs one or two tweaks here or there, one or two upgrades and the likes. You could see how Arteta has brought on year upon year. And this is probably now the kind of completion and the kind of way that he wants to set up and his way to operate. It looks nice in the eye as well, and that always helps when you've got a team that have been trophyless for a few seasons now, probably since Arteta's first season actually won the FA Cup.
He beat Frank Lampard, didn't he?
So it's heavily caveated, that trophy then, and that's what you're saying. I think as an Arsenal fan, you've got to be overjoyous, especially to overtake a team that's done it twice, because the West Ham also beat them in the League Cup this season. So it's not been an easy opponent for the Gunners this season. But yeah, it's nice as an Arsenal fan to kind of be in a title race, and it doesn't feel like it's going to fall apart when you get down the stretch.
Yeah, I've got absolutely nothing to add to that, Mike. That was very succinctly put. On West Ham, let's spend sort of 5 minutes perhaps on Davy Moyes. Maybe worth highlighting as well, they're not a team that have injury problems. You know, they've got sort of two registered first team players out, but it's two really important players in Paquetá and Antonio. Antonio missing means Bowen's sort of playing in this striker role, which he definitely doesn't seem entirely comfortable with. And Paquetá missing takes away from Bowen and from Kudus as well, the kind of creative spark in the middle of the pitch that unleashes both of their better qualities. They brought in Calvin Phillips, who's had, it's such a shame to say, but an absolutely stinking start to his West Ham career. His first two games were a disaster. He comes on in this game and all he does is get himself cautioned and contributes absolutely nothing else. So it's tough for David Moyes. He seems to get, I think, an unnecessarily hard time from West Ham fans, and I suspect there's a little bit of name tax there in that he's not an overly glamorous individual, and so it's easy to sort of jump on the anti-Moyes bandwagon quicker. You could tell he's under pressure because in his post-match interviews, he was very quick to start saying how good West Ham had it. You know, he was sort of rattling off about their Europa Conference League victory, and they're still in the Europa League, aren't they? I'm right.
And
their sort of continuation in the Europa League this season and where that might get them. So interesting time to wax lyrical about how good West Ham fans have it after watching their team get gubbed 6-0. But you could tell that he was sort of, Moyes has got that in his locker, doesn't he, where he starts kind of like rattling off his successes, where he feels like people are giving him a hard time. But I don't know how you see it, Mike. I know you kind of made the joke there, you know, what's the point in a Moyes team if he can't defend set pieces, which is absolutely right. But, you know, they're still very much in the hunt for European places with a couple of important players to come back. And he's given them a phenomenal couple of seasons in Europe as well.
Yeah, I think the results this season have been kind to them in terms of their performances. I think they could put all their eggs into the Europa League basket, but considering Liverpool still in that competition, it's going to be very hard to overcome and do what he did in the Conference League. So he's got to give them a fair whack at that. And look, he might be lucky, and he might edge a Europa Conference League spot once again. And I think for a team of West Ham's size, I know what they want to be and I know what they project themselves as, but I still think that's an accomplishment. And as you've seen last time when Moyes went, it wasn't, the grass wasn't greener. and he's come back and I think he's done a tremendous job in terms of stabilising them, moving them up, being a team where you think they should be finishing top half season in, season out. And while his contract goes in the summer, and I don't think he'll be retained, I think they will try and get somebody else in with, a, like you said, a bigger profile, a bigger name, value to him. He should land on his feet somewhere else because he's it's kind of a reclamation project he's done from work at Manchester United. They went to Sociedad and he kind of had to work his way back up in terms of being named valued in the Premier League. And I think he's done that, and he's done that tremendously well. And I think it is because he's a dour Scotsman that he does get a kind of attache to him of not being a great Premier League manager. But he has proven for the best part of two and a bit decades now that he's more than capable of holding his own against all types of managers and all types of faces that have came in over the years. So I think it will be a shame when West Ham do eventually move on from him, and hopefully does land in a good opportunity elsewhere. But I do think, like, some teams, like, not every team can be top six. You need tremendous wealth now to kind of break into that bracket, as we've seen with Newcastle, and now they're struggling this season with obviously financial fair play and the Premier League's kind of profit and sustainability rules. Chelsea spent an ordinary amount of money over the last 3 or 4 years, and it's not come to fruition since they won the Champions League under Tuchel. So it's like, you throw money at it, you can do whatever you want. Sometimes you just need that kind of bit of breaking luck as well, but you need to plan for everything. I don't think West Ham are the best planners over the years. I think it's been a bit of a scattergun approach, and I think stuff behind the scenes needs to improve if West Ham want to build upon the fact that they've got a 60,000 seater stadium that they can park week in, week out. Obviously, can you get out of it pretty quickly? I showed at half time, and 25,000 obviously left through the doors there. So I do think it's a shame what's going to happen to David Moyes at the end of the campaign, but West Ham have got to be careful. But they know fine well they've been in the Championship enough times in the past 10 years that it's not just going to be a name value that's going to come in and pick you up and put you in the top six. It's not as easy as that.
Yeah, I think, again, absolutely perfect. The big point there for me is the risk. Like, Aberdeen fans are sometimes guilty of this as well. I don't think you necessarily need to move on for the sake of moving on. You know, David Moyes is doing an absolutely solid job, and some seasons might not be as good as others, but you are in such a, and I don't think that's lacking ambition either. You know, they give themselves a chance in the cups. It's fucking hard to win a cup. Like, who was the last team to win a cup that wasn't a traditional cup-winning team?
Leicester, Rodgers.
Yeah, yeah, the FA Cup. But even then, that was a Leicester team that had won the Premier League sort of 3-4 years before, and we're still kind of riding off of the back of Champions League money and European money. And then before that, it's Swansea.
Wigan, Swansea.
You know, so we're picking out three examples from the last kind of like 15 years. Because then you had, was it Portsmouth that beat Cardiff under Harry Redknapp before that? Yeah, so that's four examples in the last 15 years. So 30 cups of a team that have sort of non-traditional cup-winning team that have managed to pull something out of the bag. So Moy seems to try and give them a chance. And they've won a fucking European trophy. It might be the Conference League, but Jesus wept. Like, they're not gonna forget those memories anytime soon. And you could just see them getting in their own Frank de Boer, and the season starting badly, and suddenly it becomes a firefighting job, and you just longingly look back to the days of Davy Moyes, a guy that's got over 1,000 Premier League games under his belt as well, which is absolutely incredible.
I just add on to that as well. Moyes has tried to change his approach in terms of he's bringing in Paqueta, he's bringing in Kudos, he's brought in Bowen, even though he's English, he probably didn't quite get the kind of cachet as well that he would with like some of the foreign players that have come in. He's trying to adapt the way that they play to be more forward footed. I think Antonio said in that podcast with Callum Wilson that they got too far away from what took them to the dance initially when they brought in like Scamacca and it wasn't quite working. And it needs a kind of more gradual approach on the boys to say, like for the defence first team, this is how you can now go front foot against teams, maybe not the top six, but maybe like Fulham, Everton, etc. And how we can kind of go in and control games. And like, there was an instance that they picked out a match day two when they had a corner or something like that, or they broke in possession in the final third against Arsenal, but they just started playing it all the way back. And you can see Moyes being apathetic on the sidelines, that they weren't pushing forward and they were going forward, they're going back to square one, having to build up from the start as well. So he does want these teams to be more, well, defensively solid. He does want these teams to get up the park more and be more attacking and control more of the play, but it's just going to be an eventual gradual process. But I don't think he's going to get that time. And I will caveat with, if Hasenhüttl comes into West Ham, Moyes can get the sack. I don't particularly care, because I'd like to see Hasenhüttl back in the Premier League as well.
Hasenhüttl at West Ham would be good value, to be fair. That would be that would be good fun, but possibly good for England as well if he could continue to develop Bowen through his prime. But poor wee Davy Moyes, because you think he might go onto the Roy Hodgson shelf, that once this West Ham job is past him, you might struggle to see him back in the Premier League. Then again, somebody will be close to relegation and fucking bring him in for 10 games, won't they? So what am I talking about? And the final title protagonist, we go to Anfield. That was Liverpool's third goal, also coming from a set piece, their third header against Burnley. Part of the reason I wanted to play that goal in particular was the amount of different Liverpool players that were named from a goal that comes from a corner without Burnley managing to clear it is absolutely appalling. Like the fact that Jota has time to bring it down in the box from a corner before taking a shot, and then it goes to Harvey Elliott, who's completely unmarked, to put in a fresh cross, is genuinely appalling. And while we're sort of meant to be talking about title protagonists, Mike, I think for this game, I want to start with Burnley. They've conceded the most goals from set pieces, save for Nottingham Forest, not including penalties. And it seems to be week in, week out that they're shipping 1, 2, 3 goals from corners or free kicks. They seem completely incapable of defending. They play the same style. They're probably the only team that we've got right. Remember after week 7, we did that sort of like shape up of where all the teams faced. And we had Burnley in the kind of like all style, no substance section, along with Bournemouth. And Bournemouth sort of have kind of kicked on a little bit from there, but Burnley certainly haven't. 7 points adrift, possibly more, because Luton have a game in hand. And the question I wanted to put to you, Mike, was just like whether company is getting away with murder here. I can't think of an example of another Premier League manager doing this poorly with so little being said about him. Not that I want to encourage people to get sacked, I'm hastened to add, but it's an interesting dynamic that he seems to have at Burnley.
I think Company's being clever in the sense that if he reverts the type, goes down the David Moyes route of being route one and Burnley are still this poor, then that kind of puts his potential future managerial jobs in jeopardy. But while he's promoting this kind of modern way of playing the game, he's setting himself up for more and more jobs down the line, because he's got a name value as well as a Premier League great, and of course he's come from like Belgium, so he's got foreign claims as well, which always seems to be an extra kind of feather in the bow for chairman to make their signings as well. So I do think that he's been clever about this, but not being pragmatic enough to keep Burnley in the division. And I think Burnley, in a sense, have actually accepted the fact that they're going to do what Deitch did in his first kind of spell as well, is they'll have a crack at it in the first go, but they'll come back down and hopefully come back better for it the second time. You've seen Burnley's longevity in the second period under Deitch until he got sacked and then eventually went down as well. So I do think that he is getting away with murder, but by the same token, there is a thought process to it. Like, it's a risk. Of course, it's a risk because there's no guarantee you'll come back. But if you look at the team in the Championship, they've got the parachute money. They're at the top of the table just now as well. So I do think there's a risk that they don't come back. But I do think they're prepared. Like, we've spent a good amount of money on players who have got the potential and can improve and come back better for the second time. But company's been smart as well, thinking like if I just kind of revert to type and go route one, then I'm not going to get a move to a Bournemouth next time, or a Palace, or a Brighton, etc. So I do think it's a hard one to ascertain. But as we've said about teams that are in the kind of low reaches of the division being kind of safe and not pull the trigger on the managers, I do think the teams that are in the relegation zones as well have kind of accepted the fact that it's going to be difficult this year to stay up. Do we just throw all the planning out of a year or a bit to kind of bring in Sam Allardyce for 30 games, 20 games, 5 games, 10 games, whatever it's going to be?
Leeds got away with that in a sense, didn't they? Because by doing that, they could have really fucked themselves, but managed to sort of hire wisely in the summer, and it seems to be paying off. But there's never any guarantee that you can do that again. I suppose the other side of the coin, Mike, with Burnley is that they just, and I think we've said this probably almost fortnightly on the podcast, is that they just risk becoming a bit more like less like Burnley 1.0 and more like Norwich under Farker, who dominate the Championship sort of season after season and then flounder in the Premier League season after season as well. I think, did he get 2 cracks at the Premier League, maybe even 3? Certainly at least 2. No, I do understand. I think the thing that I find harder to forgive him for is not going full Sam Allardyce and lumping men behind the ball and hoping to cling on for points and completely giving up on your style of play. But they just, where Luton seem to be able to learn and are adapting, and then players are improving and stepping up to the challenges and the quality, and you're really seeing like a couple of names at Luton that you're like, oh, these guys, you know, these guys look like they could be sort of Premier League stalwarts of the future. And we discussed them at length last week, guys that are really kind of starting to make a bit of a name for themselves with the opportunity. Whereas I just don't think you're getting that at Burnley, that I don't think they've got a single player that you could say is stepping up to the challenge and trying to drag that team forward. And part of that, I think, is with company just not adapting anything. Like, there's one thing, sticking to your principles, but surely he can look at the league and say, okay, my principles were great in the Championship, but I've got to do something. I've got to learn to do something slightly different here. Whether that isn't, you know, playing out from the back quite as deep as we do, we move everything 10, 15 yards further forward, whether it's changing how they defend. Because arguably, if they changed how they defend set pieces, they might be doing all right, actually, to be perfectly honest. So maybe it's as simple as that. Like, wait a minute, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot here with the way that we defend corners. We've got to study teams that do it well and learn how to do it differently. And some managers say it's as simple as wanting to go ahead of the ball. Other managers will say it's an intricate zonal system. Some implement a mixture of zonal and man-to-man. I've got no idea what Burnley do, but whatever it is, it doesn't work. And that lack of adaptation, if I was a Burnley fan, now 24 games into the season, I think would be what's given me bigger concern long-term than necessarily the fact that we're not scoring many points.
Yeah, and not scoring many goals either. Like, their XG is roughly the same as Sheffield United's, which is the worst in the division. And they're not outperforming. I think they're slightly outperforming it, but not by any great margin. So I think, like, even with the pretty patterns of play and all of that going into it as well, they've not got a guy that's putting the ball in the back of it or even creating chances for someone to put the ball in the back of it. I think they've got Fofana off Chelsea. He scored 2 the other week.
He scored 2 last week off the bench, but he had 2 glorious chances this week and fluffed them both.
Yeah, and I think that's what they're missing as well. I think they've still got Jay Rodriguez in the books. I mean, very good pro to have around the place, but again, it's not going to keep you up in a division, is he? His weight of goals, and it never kind of has in his career either. So I do think it's, like you said, that changing the way that you play is, like, even the way that you play is not producing chances to score. It's not like a Brighton where it's kind of basketball style and it's end-to-end and you're losing games potentially 4-3 or 5-4. You're just getting battered now, and you've got nothing in return anyway, so they can be a bit more gung-ho knowing you can't get anything in the back. I'll give them slight credit, like, they did give Liverpool a scare at Turf Moor around the Christmas period. Even though Liverpool went on to win that game quite comprehensively in the end. And for the first half hour, until the goal, Burnley looked all right and looked quite even in some aspects of the game. But yeah, they just don't have the sheer quality to even lift them up above teams like Nottingham Forest. You know, I mean, and that's a bit of a worry if you're a Burnley fan at this moment in time. And I mean, are they bottom of the table or they're shared bottom of the table with Sheffield
shared
United?
Bottom with Sheffield United? They're above them. They're basically above them because Sheffield United lost sort of 8-0 to Newcastle and have had another pumping in there as well. It's kind of the only difference between them at the moment.
Yeah, and that's kind of going. It's like if you're going down to be 7 points worse off than Luton, who came up through the playoffs and are kind of tagged as plucky underdogs, haven't spent a great amount of money to stay in the division because they definitely know like they've got to come back stronger for the next time because they just don't have that kind of, well, they're building the stadium as well to go into things like they weren't planned to come up this season, as shown by the fact that they had to spend $10 million just to redevelop their stadium to make it Premier League compliant. So that's
mental in 2023, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, so like that's the more kind of damning thing I think for Burnley. To an extent, it's like they're on the same amount of points as a team who almost hit administration if they didn't go up, and a team whose stadium's crumbling, and that's why they're moving out. And a stadium whose shares the kind of same road as a row of flats and houses as well. So it's like it's not necessarily this modern great sight to behold, Kenilworth Road. But I think that's the more kind of damning aspects for Burnley rather than can they defend or not. It's like they've spent a lot of money to be as poor as Sheffield United.
Yeah, exactly. If they went down with 35 points playing well, you'd maybe forgive them, like you say, to go down at possibly 7, 10, 15 points behind a Luton team that were miles off them in the Championship last season. It is significantly more damning, for sure. I was going to say that I'll wrap us up. We actually haven't mentioned Liverpool at all, but to be honest, Mike, from this game, there's nothing to say on Liverpool. They managed to get another win without Salah. It was headers. They gave up a few chances at the back. The most important thing for Klopp was the 3 points, and they keep themselves in the title race.
Yeah, and they're still quite solid defensively, even though they've not had a settled kind of back line for a few months now. Trent's obviously out for a few more weeks. Conor Bradley's potentially going to come in, or is it going to be Joe Gomez? So again, Roy Robertson's come back. He's just getting into the flow of games. Simicast, his replacement's coming back, and he's going to be sitting on the bench now. So I think Liverpool have actually kind of, while they're still juggling with injuries, I think they've still kind of manned the kind of fort well in terms of defensively. That they've managed to keep themselves in games, and obviously, like you said, with Salah being in the AFCON and getting injured now, for them to still be leading this kind of charge at the top of the table and going across all these competitions as well, Klopp deserves a lot of kind of praise and credit that kind of gone under the radar that how well they're doing. And they've not had the fully fit 11 on the park for 3-4 months now.
Yeah, I absolutely. It's the back line's actually quite, I think it's quite interesting the way that they're sort of chopping and changing between them, between different fullbacks, different centre backs. But I could hear the Conor Bradley football, fantasy football manager tone in your voice there when you pitched that lineup. Laundry for Klopp, but that'll do us for the Premier League. We'll finish off with a trip north as Aberdeen came from 3 goals behind against Motherwell. Yeah, what a... Where to fucking start with this shite? Motherwell going 3-0 up after half an hour. Aberdeen and Neil Warnock starting one of the most peculiar 11s you'll probably see in the Scottish Premiership this season. Proven by the fact that every Aberdeen fan group chat I'm in and Twitter was awash with confusion as to how we were actually lining up. We started with one centre-back in a back five. We started with almost one out-and-out defender in a back five, which is unbelievable. But a centre-back with two full-backs either side of him, with two attacking number 10/winger players either side of them. Steve Tosh was very complimentary in commentary, saying that we were going for it and we wanted to get goals. It certainly led to goals, all right. Unfortunately, the goals that it led to were for Motherwell, as they took advantage of our somehow narrow formation, despite playing wing-backs, exploited the wings and left poor Stefan Gartenman to try and defend the entire box on his own. Nicky Devlin was was constantly in the wrong place, but I'm willing to forgive him given that he was playing alongside Shaden Morris, who I think we might have seen for the last time in an Aberdeen top, hooked after 30 minutes. And Jack McKenzie had a similar problem on the other side, trying to fill in for Jamie McGrath. 3-0 down. Neil Warnock made two changes, brought on Duke, brought on Angus McDonald to go to a back four with two up top, basically a 4-4-2, and we score within about 30 seconds of that change, make it 3-2 before half-time. Both goals going for VAR review, much to the dismay of the Pittodrie crowd. And then we come out for the second half, and you know that Motherwell are stressed. They were 3-0 up, they thought the game was won, and suddenly it's a one-goal advantage. And within 5 minutes, as we heard there, Duke gets his second to make it 3-3, and with 40 minutes to go, Aberdeen on top. You think, fantastic, here we go, it's all square. Let's go on and win this game. Let's get 4 or 5 and put it to bed. And for some reason, we just lost all momentum, and Motherwell dug in, and it was Motherwell that were the other team to put the ball in the back of the net, going 4-3 up for their goal to be disallowed for, in fairness, a unbelievably blatant push on Jamie McGrath at the back post, and VAR coming to Aberdeen's rescue, because to have lost from there would have been appalling. But yeah, unfortunately, having got it to 3-3, they seemed to revert to kind of hoofball pretty quickly and stop doing all the things that had worked to get them back into the game, which then leaves you with the conclusion that Aberdeen have drawn at home against a terrible Motherwell side in a game that they really had to win to try and keep their European hopes alive. They've possibly got one final shot at it against Hibs to get all 3 points and maybe be able to kind of get a run going. But an exciting game, Mike, a crazy result, but ultimately very disappointing for Aberdeen. But it must have been a good laugh for you.
It was hilarious when I was listening to the radio and just had Willie Miller's updates of how it was Motherwell 1, Motherwell 2, Motherwell 3. Where's this going to go? It's like all the goodwill that Warnock kind of built up through the Rangers game, but they gave them a shot in the Bonnie Rose game. Okay, that could have been a slippery one for a manager who's just come in the door and kind of got a shock. No, potentially could have got beat, but could have got took into a replay, for example. And I just think just very strange the way to like playing like that, thinking that was going to be the case, that this is going to get me the result that's required. Like I said, going one centre back, it's a bit like Gordon Strachan versus Gibraltar that one time when he played one centre back and kind of two full backs to kind of complement it in terms of trying to run over the top of the opposition. And it's like Motherwell have just scored 5 against Ross County. Of course, they're a bit down on morale because they got beat off Greenock Morton on Friday, which of course the Morton would have watched because that's Morton's other team, of course, got a brick in the wall, etc. But I just thought it was very strange the way to approach that game. And thinking that this is the kind of team that's going to get me the result, when all the fans are kind of united the other way, thinking this is a very strange kind of lineup and formation to go with. But in the one aspect, you've got to say fair play to him. He's got his nous and he's all his experience behind him to make the changes, because it must be disheartening to pull two guys off after 25 minutes and kind of admit that you're wrong. And especially trying to lift the two individuals who have been taken off as well. Paul Barrow, who no fault of his own, he just has to shake up and make McDonald back into a centre-back and go to the back four. So I think it's, on one aspect, you've got to say fair play. He's learned from his wrongs. He's just in the door. He's maybe tried something that hasn't worked, but he's rectified. And you could have potentially gone on to win the game, which would have been morale crushing for Motherwell, who are on a decent run in the league. But yeah, very strange, and hopefully he's learned his lesson for the Hibs game upcoming, because that, like you said, that's an important game, especially with Kilmarnock coming the following Saturday. If you want to claw back and try and get to European place, then that needs to be 6 points to reel them back into.
Yeah, 100% needs to be 6 points. Otherwise, it is genuinely, you know, you're looking for snookers at that point. I think you're right. I think, you know, trying to be objective about it, he learned from his mistake, which was great. The thing that confused me slightly in his post-match interview, he said, you know, the difficulty started when we lost Jensen in the morning to illness, and we had to try and do something different. And I just think, why was there something different not simply playing Angus McDonald instead of Richard Jensen? Like, surely it's not like you didn't have a like-for-like change. You had a like-for-like change. The four at the back system had looked solid against Rangers and you know, Bonnie Rigg, it's a you can't really take too much away from him, but we didn't concede. So, you know, that's fine. And so I thought that was a bit silly. I thought it sort of had a bit of Football Manager about it. Like, oh, fuck it, we'll just chuck all these players on and something will be all right. But he did learn, and we got out with it. We got out of it with a bloody nose, but we haven't been knocked out. And like you say, hopefully he's learned now, and it's very much four at the back going forward. And Duke looked a bit like old Duke, which is perhaps a positive. The two up front seemed to look good. Duke playing off the left. I think the only other thing is just the way that we reverted to hoofball once it was 3-3. I just thought it's infuriating. But, you know, Warnock said, from the point of the substitution, that's how I expect my team to play. And they've learned that now, and hopefully they can take that forward, and, like you say, into the Hibs game. It's just, I think there's a bit of, I think Warnock is going to be one of those managers for Aberdeen that his goodwill is incredibly short. I think he, you know, a bad result against Hibs, and I think that's it. It's done, it's out the window. Like, if we lose to Hibs, or even draw against Hibs, I think Warnock's lost all sort of credit with the fans, because while we could get behind it in a sort of, it'll be a laugh, it's fine, it's only 4 months, that was all under the premise that the results would improve and we'd work our way back up the table. None of that was on the basis that it would continue to be shite. And if it wasn't for Livingston, we'd be worried about going down. So I think he needs to be slightly careful that, and he did well to praise the fans in the post-match and said, you know, that they could have really thrown them under the bus, and they didn't. They got behind them. From people I know that were at the game, there was quite a few boos still at full time, and probably rightly so, given the overall picture of the match. But yeah, he doesn't have any credit in the bank, that's for sure. And so he doesn't have long to get it right before things could get quite ugly. Again, he made a joke in his initial press conference that he wasn't going to get sacked, but if he goes 3-0 down to Hibs in 30 minutes, he might be staring down the barrel of getting sacked. Look, all in all, at the point of 3-0 down, yeah, it's great. Taking the game in a hole, it's a poor result for Aberdeen, and I think that has to be the main takeaway. But hopefully it's enough for him, the other coaching staff, and the players themselves to give everybody a kick up the arse and really fix it for Hibs. Because as we were saying before we came on, it's a poor division, a really, really, really poor division. It has been for a couple of years, which is why Aberdeen were able to make the comeback last season and finish third. That's on the cards again, albeit this year for fourth. Hearts have improved and got some consistency, and they'll be fine. They'll finish third. But there is very much an opportunity here for Aberdeen to go on a similar sort of run and then finish fourth, which is European football. It's not the guaranteed group stages we had last year, but it's an opportunity all the same. They just need to, runs like that need to start somewhere though. And it needs to start for me against Hibs at the absolute latest, now that it hasn't started against Motherwell. Because Kilmarnock, albeit a poor division, are the best of a poor bunch, and the one that have just about enough consistency to kind of tick away. And we know that Dennett McInnes has the experience and the nous to get teams over the line at this time of the season. Unfortunately, that was born through his tenure at Aberdeen. So, the Don's trying to undo that a little bit. And I suppose that's it. Kind of just, I've monologued myself into corner here, Mike. That's all I'm trying to say. So if you've got anything to add, please feel free to do so now.
Yeah, and the other thing is, really, it's like you can't just keep holding on and holding on and holding on, because a split's going to come. So you need to be in the dance to get a partner. And I think that's, if you kind of muddle along, say you get two draws here, okay, that's your game hand will be gone after you go to another place. I think there's one game, I think it's St Johnston maybe, that's your game in hand.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct.
But like at one point in time this weekend, St Johnston were in the top six. It's like you might be unfortunate and one team gets balloted out, but it's going to be Hibs or Aberdeen or even both of you. So it could potentially come down to the fact that if you just keep muddling along, pick up these draws, and hope things are to go.
Oh, sorry, it's my apologies. It's Dundee. The game in hand's against Dee. Yeah, yeah.
Are they not six at the moment in time as well? So like you've got to be careful of the fact that okay, things could turn and performances can improve, but if you're not putting points on the board and the points mean the wins, you can find yourself on the outside looking in, and it's not going to be a good situation for you in terms of trying to get to the European spot once again. And Hibs and yourselves have spent a hell of a lot of money to be finishing in the bottom six.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, just to sum up how bad a division it is, the bottom six teams, Motherwell, Hibs, Aberdeen, St Johnstone, Ross County, Livingston, across the last six games, so that's 36 games in total, have two wins.
Yep.
That's insane, which is Motherwell against Ross County and St Johnstone against Ross County, who are the bottom six teams. Like two wins out of 36 across six teams. That's absolutely appalling. Whereas Hearts have got five wins on the bounce. Like that's absolutely crazy. And showing their consistency. And you know, they're short of Aberdeen winning the Scottish Cup, they'll get guaranteed group stage football next season, which is huge. And Aberdeen getting that, the point of Aberdeen getting that was meant to be, here's 5 million quid, go and solidify third, start kicking on, make something of it. And yeah, we've taken a massive step backwards. And as of next season, the coefficient means that it's going to be increasingly difficult for Scottish teams to qualify for Europe again, like Aberdeen suffered under Derek McInnes. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not going to take much for somebody to miss out here. We are only 3 points behind Dundee on the same games. We do still need to play them twice before the split. But as I've said, we need to put the run together. It's got to start with Hibs at the weekend. And we really need to have our sights on Kilmarnock, who are 10 clear of us at the moment, and St Mirren that are just behind them, to sort of salvage what is left of this wreckage of a season. And my God, I hope the club are doing some good research to find a manager in the summer. Because as somebody rightly said yesterday, as much as Aberdeen should not be a place for rookies to learn their trade, it also shouldn't be a place for old codgers to have a bit of a laugh as well, which is sort of where we're at the moment. I think that'll do us for this week, Mike. We're getting very good at this hour thing. We've sort of found a rhythm in the last few weeks. So that was fantastic. Great discussion. We got to bring some breaking news. Will I check if it's been announced yet? We can actually, no, still just set to sack Hodgson as of 13 minutes ago. So he hasn't officially, there's no announcement yet, but that just means we're ahead of the curve, mate. We're in the know is really what's going on here. But it's been fantastic speaking to you as always, Mike. Thanks for your time. We'll catch up again next week. Cheers.
Cheers.